Welcome to Inside Voices, a well-read magazine between the pages podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Robert Gwaltney.
And I'm another host, Jeffrey Dale Lofton. And we are so excited to enter into conversation today with authors Byron Lane and Stephen Rowley. Byron and Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We're glad you're here. Before we begin today, we want to share a little bit about you with our listeners.
So I'm going to start by introducing Byron Lane. He's an author, playwright, and screenwriter. His latest novel, Big Gay Wedding, is about a family and a small town forever changed by a gay marriage. His debut novel is called A Star is Born, about an uptight celebrity assistant struggling to manage his eccentric movie star boss, inspired in part by Lane's time as assistant to beloved actress Carrie Fisher. The New York Times Book Review hails it wildly funny, and People Magazine raves funny, dishy, deeply affectionate, the force is with him.
And Stephen is the best-selling author of Lily and the Octopus, a Washington Post notable book of 2016, the editor, named by NPR and Esquire magazine, as one of the best books of 2019, and The Gunkle, a Goodreads Choice Awards finalist for 2021, and winner of the 22nd Thurber Prize for American Humor. That's a big deal.
Yes. Congratulations.
It's been published in 20 languages. How did you learn 20 languages, Steve?
Yeah, I did all the translations myself, absolutely.
Busy fella.
They sent you copies of the translation to the foreign publishers, which is a lot of fun. But beyond looking at the covers, is it even my book? Who knows? It's a roll of the dice.
Well, I'm sure it makes a beautiful display on a book. And Stephen's latest novel is The Celebrants, also published later this month. There it is.
Oh.
Okay, guys, all tea and no shade. What's life like in a two-author household, especially given that you've both got books coming out at the same time?
It's war. It's constant fighting. We're not getting a lot. No, it's great.
I think a lot of people think that we orchestrated this, and having books published on the same day is a complete coincidence. We have different publishers. We have different agents. We wrote them at slightly different times too. It is just the way that it happened to work out. And so I don't know how we thought at first, but I think we've chosen to lean into it and try to have some fun with it.
Oh, it's going to be great. I get to tour with Stephen, which is going to be really fun. And I think I get a little bit more out of it than he does. But on the whole scope of publishing, I get more, like I can go to him with ideas. I can go to him and say, hey, how did this work with your book cover? How did this work with you getting blurbs? So it's kind of great for me.
It is wonderful to have somebody on that journey with you, especially, because writing is such a, it's an experience of isolation, basically, and an act of perseverance. So it's wonderful that the two of you have one another to be able to lean on when a book is coming out at the world.
Yeah, I always say, absolutely, it's a very solitary endeavor. And that doesn't mean we don't have great teams, our agents, our editors, there's a marketing, a publicity team behind us, too. But particularly during the drafting process or that first time you're going through it, it is a very solitary endeavor. And the weird thing about it is you don't get to ever witness anybody else, any of your peers also doing the job. So, I don't know what it's like for another writer to do this, but yet we have this little window into watching someone else do the job. And I'm grateful for that in a way, because I think, we can both learn a lot, and we can both be good advocates for each other too.
And we understand when the normal writer things happen, like you're having a terrible day, I get it. Or if Stephen is like, I can't just sit and watch TV tonight. I gotta go work. Or he likes to make.
I always want to just sit and watch TV though. So it's okay.
Yeah, it's really. Or you have an idea and be like, oh, let me go. I'm going to go write that down real quick. I think we get that.
The biggest fights though come from if we're leaving dinner parties or something, or we've both been at the same place and we overhear some juicy tidbit and we're like, no, I'm using that. That's mine. I claim it.
I love that. So how would you, in regards to your processes, are you very similar in your approach to the work? I know, Stephen, you were just saying that you really some nights just rather sit on the sofa. and watch Netflix, which I'm right there with.
Some nights? I think that's every night. Yeah.
Every night.
I don't know. I think it's slightly different. I approach it with a word count. I really have a word count goal for the day, and I try to be disciplined about hitting that. And then the rest of my day can shift. So for instance, right now, when we have books coming out, there's a lot to do. And I'll wake up, because we're on the West Coast and our publishers are in New York, that I'll wake up to email, I'll have things to do. And it's not really until 2 o'clock or so, when the end of the workday comes in New York, where I feel like it quiets down enough that I can attempt to write then. Whereas normally I would prioritize writing in the morning, I think. So it just depends what else, what other parts of the job are going on.
And I tend to, I get up early with the dogs. So I'm up at 6 in the morning, and so I'll get some writing done then.
I sleep in because I'm up late watching Netflix.
Crazy. I think I do more thorough outlining than you.
I'm a pantser.
I like to take time, go on long walks and work out scenes and things like that. So in those ways, I think we're different.
How do you, Stephen, in particular, if you're a pantser, do you outline it all and then not stick to it? How do you get the story arc if you don't have an idea, in some sort of format, what you want to do?
I forget who the writer was that said this, but I'm not truly a pantser, and that I have no idea what's going on. I subscribe to the sort of headlight theory, which is I sort of know, if you're driving at night, imagine headlamps, and you can see a certain distance in front of you. It's just what's beyond what the light can reach that I don't necessarily know. But by seeing a little bit ahead at a time, I can build sort of brick by brick by brick. And then that helps me see a little bit further down the road and a little bit further down the road. And somehow I make that work. I generally have a good sense of my starting point, and I have a good sense of the ending. But it's the journey in between that I sort of figure out through trial and error sometimes.
But page 307.
Brilliant.
He's got it.
So Byron, what about you? Does that element of him sort of being a pantser and not being quite as well plotted as you, does that eke over into other aspects of your life together?
Oh, that's very interesting.
I think it does now that you mention it. Oh my God, relationship breakthrough.
I've been waiting for years for this kind of breakthrough. I do think in general, I'm a little bit, I would say, feel free to disagree. I think I'm a little more prepared. I like to plan things out a little bit more.
I think if we needed to buy a new couch, for instance, Byron would want to sit down, do all the research, find it, look at every place online, and just get it done. Whereas I'm like, the couch will present itself to us eventually. We'll stumble upon it somewhere in our adventures, and I'm not in as much of a rush.
So Byron, if you do sort of plan, more structured in your approach to writing, how do you achieve this really spontaneous, funny, sort of out of left field humor that you're able to, to put on the page? How do you do that?
Well, that is, thank you for saying that. That means a lot to me to hear that that's how my writing's perceived. I don't know. I'm a little bit kind of weird, I think. So I just kind of try to let it happen. But, my background is in journalism. So I was a television news writer and for a while a television news reporter. And in New Orleans, I was a producer and a writer. And in New Orleans, you have these characters who appear on the news every night when they're doing interviews in neighborhoods and whatever. And those characters are so rich. And so I came into writing novels with a sense of what it's like to have a rich personality, what kind of sound bites make a great headline, And so I think it helped me. Journalism helped me sort of boil out a lot of the non-essential stuff and stick to what's really rich.
Yeah, I think that helps with novel writing, particularly because as a noted humorist now, I'm going to start every sentence that way.
He starts every day like that.
He's an award-winning humorist, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is that engraved on the award?
I'm going to go double check right now, actually. I'll be right back. But I will think, you know, like, it takes a long time to write a novel. And then also publishing is a very long lead industry. So I can be typing away thinking, oh, I've come up with a really great joke. And then I realize, like, oh, it could be 2 or 3 years before anybody realizes it. And then, you know, as a humorist, it's a terrible return on investment because, oh, by the way, I won't even be in the room if it gets a laugh. And so I think the way, and then beyond that, once your book does come out, you hope it has a long shelf life, right? So you can't write topical humor. You're not writing a Tonight Show monologue or anything like that. And as Byron says, the real secret to writing humor, I think, in novel format is through really authentic characters, right? It's really knowing your characters and having the jokes be very authentic to them.
Byron, what would you say that you admire most about Stephen's writing? And Stephen, I'm going to ask the same question to you.
You have to go first. I have time to think.
No. Well, my guess is we'll probably say the same thing, and that is the heart. So, you know, all of Stephen's novels are beautifully written. You know, you can look at sentences and be like, wow, those words just go good together. You can look at his novels and say, these characters are all rich. These people are all interesting. You can look at them and say, this is a beautiful world. You can look at them and say, this is really funny. But at the end of the day, I am thrilled to read his books and get emotional, cry a little bit. It's really special, and it's a unique art form, really. I mean,
did you want to read a passage that you enjoy?
Want me to read?
Absolutely.
No, absolutely.
That's my favorite thing about his writing is the heart, and it's sneaky. It's a little sneaky. Do you?
Oh, I was just gonna say sneaky. Sneaky wasn't gonna be quite the word, but my favorite thing I think about Byron's writing is It's that thing that comes out of left field that completely catches you by surprise, whether it's an emotion or, or a joke or whatnot. I'm constantly surprised in a great way. And it's interesting when you live with someone, you think you know their toolkit in a way, you think you know their bag of tricks. And Byron's holding on to some skills and keeping them from me, I think, because they end up on the page. And even I, someone who knows him well, and sometimes have read draft after draft after draft, still have the ability to be pleasantly surprised.
How dare you? You don't read that many drafts.
Isn't that sort of the banter that you have at home? The really sometimes sort of very fast, really quick-witted dialogue that are in both of your novels. Is it like that at your house? And how
people were fighting. Sorry, we don't fight a lot. I don't know. You know what's weird is I know this frustrates Stephen. Like, I laugh at things that are dumb and kind of accidental, spontaneous. But he's funny, so he will.
I'll have a well-constructed joke.
It'll be great,
and you'll be like, "That's funny," and then I'll just go boop, blop, lorp, and you'll
hilarious.
Yeah, die laughing.
So I can't explain it.
So I want to Stephen, I'm going to just transition back over to you. I'm a huge fan of your writing, and I'm really looking for, I've not had the opportunity yet to read Celebrants because as of today, it is officially not out, but there are a lot, I'm not the only one anticipating your book. The Celebrants is one of BuzzFeed's most anticipated LGBTQ books of 2023. One of Entertainment Weekly's best new books for spring. And one of Reader's Digest's most anticipated summer books. And I do want to share just a couple of things some people said about your book before I turn it over to you for you to set the novel up for our listeners. Rowley has created such living, breathing characters that the heartbreaking truth, this is a book about a character's impending death, is truly heartbreaking. I kept Kleenex in business while reading this book, but I also laughed a whole lot. It's a sort of heartwarming story that makes me want to ring up my pals for a much needed visit. That's Reader's Digest editor's pick. Wonderful praise. And this is what Publishers Weekly has to say. Rowley offers another winning story of a friend group held together by an unusual bond. Genuinely heartfelt, Rayleigh admirably avoids sentimentality along the way, and there's plenty of fresh and witty dialogue. For anyone needing a reminder about the importance of friendships, this will more than do the trick. Congratulations. I mean, it's a lot of wonderful anticipation in the community and a lot of advanced praise for your work.
Well, I don't like to read reviews, so that's really great to hear that. I'm going to call you, Robert, and have you read me all of my reviews in the future. Just
I would be delighted anytime.
I was like, maybe I should, because I'm always like, you know, yeah, a little nervous. Thank you. This is a deeply personal one, I think, on several levels. One, it is about a group of college friends, close-knit college friends who reunite periodically over the years. I do have a group of close-knit college friends. Two, I was inspired by the movie The Big Chill, which is a movie from the early 80s. It's now 40 years old, but we rewatched it early in the pandemic when we were sheltering at home. And again, I was on the couch with Netflix and I'm rewatching this movie. And, you know, it's about middle-aged ennui and what, characters stressing about what the back half of their lives are going to look like. And all the characters are 35 years old. And I was like, boy, we've really changed what we've thought of as middle-aged. And then, and it is a movie where, The Big Chill was a movie where they get together after the loss of one of their own and contemplate their own mortality for the first time. And in real life, I did lose one of my best friends to breast cancer right before the pandemic. And so there is something about losing a contemporary the first time that does make you question your mortality, in a different way than losing a parent or something which there's a natural order to things, but with losing a friend that can happen, there is no deal. That can happen anywhere, particularly where I am in true middle age now, where I have friends who are 20 years older and friends who are 20 years younger. And so, it was just a lot that went into this, the recipe for this book.
And Byron, let's hear about you. I mean, your new novel, Big Gay Wedding, has received some wonderful advanced praise as well. For example, it's been named a most anticipated book by Lambda Literary, by Zibby Owens, and by Book Riot, among others. And I'll read something that Booklist put out about your book. Lane's latest is even more chaotic than his debut, in a good way, with a multitude of wild yet fully fleshed out characters and a plot that never lets up. Hilarious moments blend perfectly with genuine emotional arcs. Pretty good.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah.
I love chaotic as praise. I think that's fantastic.
Me too.
Yeah. That makes me want to read.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. So Byron, will you set it up for us? Tell us about it.
Sure. So Big Gay Wedding is about a conservative mom who runs a rescue farm for misfit animals in a small rural town. And she clashes with her gay son who wants to have his wedding at the family farm. So it's a little bit Father of the Bride. It's a little bit Schitt's Creek. And I grew up in the South. So I tried to take characters who I knew from my childhood and from now and pluck those spirits and put them in the characters of this book. So I hope that it reads as authentic and loving, and it's also a little challenging. Some of the characters in the book have to come to terms with real life in some ways, and really it's a book about a mom coming out as loving and accepting her gay son, and that's really the heart of this story. And I certainly relate to that. I relate to relatives in the South who were uncomfortable with me being gay, and then had to come to terms with it, not just for themselves, but for telling their pals on the construction site or at the school where they work, that kind of thing. So so that's Big Gay Wedding.
That's beautiful. And Father of the Bride and Schitt's Creek, that's a smash up I'm all for.
Yay! Okay, great. That
sounds like fun. Wow. Well, can you tell us, without giving something away, about those sort of difficult coming to terms with situations or relationships or realizations?
In real life or in the book?
In the book.
In the book. So Chrissy Durang runs this little misfit animal rescue in a little town called Mater. And she's got all kinds of like weird little critters, like a pig that hates dirt. maybe a sheep with three legs, that kind of thing. And and it turns out, like, in her view, she has a misfit in her own family. And that is her son, who's gay. And she wishes he wasn't. She's a religious person. She's in this conservative town. And even though she treats the other misfits on her farm with such love, she just struggles to bring that kind of grace to her relationship with her son. So they just don't talk about it. And then one day Barnett comes home and he has a reason to talk to her about it. And that's because he fell in love. He fell in love with this quirky guy named Ezra, who's a school teacher and a little bit out there. He has some interesting theories about the universe and how the world works and all that. But Ezra is also fearless. And so when it comes time for him to meet Chrissy, he is himself graceful and lovely and takes some of the tension off of Barnett. And the two of them, the two grooms, Barnett and Ezra, kind of have to work with Chrissy and work with the community and try to make this big gay wedding happen.
Well, those sound like beautiful journeys for those characters.
I'm looking forward to it. Jeffrey and I, on several occasions, and if you can't tell, we're both from the South.
The heck you say?
I know, it's astonishing, right?
Yeah.
Jeffrey and I have talked about, you know, our experiences growing up gay in small rural towns in Georgia. And the impact that it's had on our own writing. How would you say that your experience, your early childhood experiences and your young adult experiences growing up gay has impacted your writing?
I'll say for me, I write for the closeted kid that I was. I think, you know, I certainly sought out books and stories when I was coming out now 30 years ago about gay people and about gay lives. And the sad truth of the time about stories, you know, written in the 19, you know, up to and through the 1980s were stories about people living in the shadows or living lives that were tragic or cut short and very lonely. And I thought that's what the future would hold for me, that if I came out, that life would be lonely and sad and potentially short. And in fact, the opposite has been true. You know, coming out allows you to find community and a found family, and life has been filled with people and comparatively long. And so I still think back about that kid that I was, and now I try to write stories that yes, sometimes there's heartbreak in them, but there's also great joy, because I think life is that balance. And so I think that's how it's affected it for me.
Yeah, it was hard. I know you guys know too, growing up gay in the South was, I didn't know any gay people until I left the town that I grew up in. And so I also keep in mind, I think of like a young Byron, and what kind of messages would be healthy for him? What kind of things do I wish I could say to my younger self? And some of those things are in the book. There are a couple scenes where some homophobes are confronted, and I wish as a kid I had that kind of language, and I wish I had a language of acceptance and all that stuff. So I do think of this book and then A Star Is Born, my first novel, that in both of those, it's sort of, I wanted to make the gay characters just people, and then the gay thing was just part of it, but it's not neither book is this dramatic coming out thing. Both books are about a different journey. The first one about some depression and whatnot, and this one about marriage.
I do think too, there's a great honor, or I certainly take it as a sort of serious mantle now to write gay characters in middle age. Now, you know, I turned 50 over the pandemic and whatnot, and the, you know, for someone my age, the generation above me is largely missing, and there's, you know, there's a great tragedy to that, but there's also, because of that, there's not a lot of gay role models, gay male role models about, you know, to show me the way to grow older And it is a very youth-centered culture. And so, you know, for these stories, for me, I hope that, you know, not to put too much weight on them, but can light the way for others.
You're my older
baby. Thank you.
You're my older baby.
I agree. You know, I'm a little ahead of you. I was 54 in April, so I understand your journey and in the generation. And I recall.
By the way, what?
Yeah.
That's the only, but you know, when I turned 50, that was if anyone was just like, oh, happy birthday, I was like, no, that is a hate crime. The only wishes I'm accepting are, it's not possible. That can't be true. I want outrage only, you know.
I love that. And I will remember that. You know, I recall having access to no role models, very, very much like you, Stephen, and I know Jeffrey had the same experience, yeah. And Byron, you shared the same. I recall being desperate for connection, and I recall reading a book, The Best Little Boy in the World. I don't know if you recall mm-hmm. it, but at the time, the author that wrote it had to use a pseudonym, mm-hmm. and some years later wrote a follow-up to that and was able to actually use, because times it had changed, was able to use his true name. But I'm sitting here looking at the two of you, and I think how lovely that both of you are role models for our younger gay folks through the quality of your relationship and just through the lovely work that you do in your own literature, in writing. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. But I do want to say, too, like, you know, everything old is new again. And we're at a very precarious moment where sometimes it is hard to put yourself and your relationship out there again. If you are on social media or Twitter, you know, I certainly get called a lot of names, or, you know, my previous book, particular, The Gunkle, was about an openly gay man with custody of two young children. And there are those that think that that's very evil, and they're very vocal about it. And so, you know, there's a darkness and a nastiness again, just in these past few years, particularly with the, you know, bills coming out like the Don't Say Gay and whatnot, that's sort of driving this ugliness again. So I don't want to make it seem like everything is rosy or easy. Now, I'm proud to have my name on these books, and I will fight these fights, but it doesn't mean that there's not a cost that still comes with us.
Great. I felt that we were turning a corner, and I'm concerned. I think that we all are, certainly, the state of affairs currently in our country, and with legislation that is being passed, that we have to remain vigilant, of course.
Yeah, and it's not just anti-gay legislation. There's a lot of anti-book legislation.
Yes.
People looking to ban books, defund libraries, all this stuff that seems like we should have settled this 50 years ago. Now, you know, there are fights on many fronts, and women's rights too, that are, which is just a precarious moment in our history.
Stephen, the word you used earlier is community, and this whole last 5 minutes or so, the word keeps popping into my head. This is all about community, not just about, you know, the queer community, but being a good, you know, citizen, and to stand for something and to say something. So, and to create, and what I'm headed with this is that your books create these situations that are so sweet and endearing and disarming in how, you know, in the kindness that sort of permeates the entire story. How do you do that? Is it intentional? Why do you create stories like that to serve not just the queer community, but the whole community, all communities?
Yeah, I do say, we'll let Byron talk, but just to sort of close this out, I do think, to the extent that things have gotten better for the LGBTQ plus community, and they have, you know, for some of us more than others, right? There's a lot of work to do right now, particularly for our trans brothers and sisters. Yeah. But to the extent that it has gotten better, it is in large part because we've been able to tell our stories. And so I do think that's important. And I think that it is not helpful. It is important to be aware, but it's not helpful to just be all doom and gloom all the time. And I swear both of these books are very funny. And It's interesting now, you know, you have a book about a wedding and this book, The Celebrants. Both of these books are about coming together in celebration and in joy and in appreciation too. And so I think putting those stories out, particularly against, you know, the current backdrop are, you know, is something that I'm very proud to do.
Well, Stephen stole my answer, but I want to say a little bit of it is selfish. Because when people stop us, particularly like, I'm thinking of this one guy, Austin, who's a young guy and a friend of mine. And we met after he read A Star Is Born and loved it so much. And that feels good. It feels good to have a younger generation. I'm going to be 46, 45, 46. Oh, my God.
It's my job to know.
July.
Yeah. It is.
And so it's nice to have these younger gay guys say like, wow, I really related to that. That meant something to me. So yeah, it can be hard work and it's super frustrating and it's a slog sometimes and all that, but really rewarding when it hits home.
Yeah. Great. Speaking of slogs, writing can be.
How is your marriage?
Oh, yeah.
No, I was thinking of slogs.
Please feel free to talk. No, I was going to ask. You know, writing can sometimes. We talked about it. We touched on it a little earlier. Writing can be many hours spent sequestered behind closed doors. You know, missing friends' birthday parties when you're on a deadline or even carving out alone time simply to. You know, to ruminate on the next chapter. Like, how do you tap into the larger writing community, maybe as the perfect antidote to, you know, to really, the antidote to that?
I'm coming out as an introvert and after COVID, so I'm a little bit like, I don't mind being a little bit, you know, quiet.
I think you just haven't experienced it yet. So Byron's first novel came out during COVID, right? So you didn't get to do touring and bookstore appearances and go to book festival. The book festivals is kind of what I miss the most, because not only do you get an opportunity to interact with readers, but also you get to meet so many other writers and sometimes that you're a fan of. And so that building those friendships, I think, is important to surviving the craft of it. And, sometimes.
And of all the ills of the phones, social media and all that stuff, podcasting and listening to podcasts with writers is so rewarding. And I've been connecting with so many authors with the book coming out who are reaching out and connecting with you guys has been so amazing. So in that way, it's been the phone and social media and all that can be a great resource for it too.
So when we were talking earlier about coming out as young gay men, and I recall I grew up in South Georgia. I went to school in Tallahassee, Florida. And so I really came out as a gay man in Tallahassee. And I was able to befriend an older gay couple. And there was a gentleman named Patrick who gave me some advice. He said, so one thing that you should know, in every gay relationship, there's the cute one and the one that can cook.
Uh-oh.
Who can cook? Who's the cook? You're the cook?
Well,
so does that mean, Byron, you're the cute one?
I don't know about
the cute one.
I don't know about the cute one. Well, no. Like crazy eating thing.
The cute one follows crazy diet fads that I'm not gonna cook for. I
let me tell here's you something. Our, here's I've our seen difference. So many interesting things on TikTok. And so like my latest thing is a mason jar and you put like miso and then you put like a scoop of like vegetable bouillon in there and then rice noodles. And so like, that's my thing.
You know what I didn't hear in there? Butter, cream, delicious. Yeah.
I did not hear
anything that I would use to cook.
So like, baby, I'm gonna heat up my mason jar. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I love that you have mason jars in Palm Springs. I think that is hilarious.
I had no idea they were there.
All the canning we do in 120 degrees.
Well, I have to order them.
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, okay. So I guess it's my turn to ask. Like, okay, we talked about food and who's pretty. Who makes the best cocktail?
Oh, that's me.
That's Stephen, yeah. Too. So he's a great cook and a great, what do you call the person? A mixologist?
Sure.
Yeah. So there's always something. His latest obsession is with, is it tequila or vodka with
The tequila.
Jalapeno.
Tequila with jalapeno, cucumber, and grapefruit. Yeah.
That's good.
What's that?
What about you?
Does it have a name?
Yeah, I don't know. We have to have it. It's kind of like a, yeah, it's kind of like a spicier Paloma, but I've got to come up with a good name for it because it has that cucumber too. So it's very, spoiler alert, here's one of Byron's least favorite words. It's very refreshing.
Very refreshing.
Well, I think the cucumber should dominate the name in some way. I don't know.
Okay.
I think that's what you
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, a common trend presently is to have a cocktail to celebrate your novel. Would you say that cocktail, Stephen, the one that you just described, would that be the cocktail that best describe the celebrants?
Yeah, I think the celebrants, you know, we could just go with champagne. You know, it is about toasting each other and celebrating life. So champagne seems appropriate. I will say I wrote a book called The Editor, which came out in 2019, and I wrote a very specific cocktail into it. And it was not my favorite cocktail, but it fit the character in the book. And then everywhere I went on tour, they were force feeding me this cocktail. And so I thought in the future, I'm going to have to make sure that anything alcohol related is something that I actually want to drink, because I will be served it at every stop. Now, and then I went on to write a book called The Gunkle, which the character's theory on drinking in that is that, you know, if he has a martini, the closest he wants to be to a bottle of vermouth is looking at it from across the room. You know, if he's fixing a mimosa, just wave an orange over the glass of champagne is more than like mixers are bad. So, and then thank God that came out during COVID and I wasn't able to tour, because I would have just been hammered, you know, from stop to stop. So this time a nice glass of champagne is, I think will suit the bill.
I have a follow-up question. Do you like maple syrup?
I do, yes.
Because I think that's part of the cocktail in The Editor, right? Isn't it distilled?
It was rum, but it was a rum-based cocktail, but it was made from molasses instead.
Molasses, that's
it. Instead of sugar cane, yeah. Yeah, okay. The rum was distilled from molasses. Yeah.
And Byron, what about you? What cocktail would you pick
gay wedding? I think an old-fashioned.
For this very new fashioned wedding.
I love it.
Think, yeah.
Cool.
So you're combating old fashioned ideas with, it's almost like you need two. You need the old fashioned.
That's a good pairing.
Yeah. Is old fashioned the same as a highball?
A highball is actually a glass.
Oh. But my grandparents, Mama and Papa, they used to have a highball or two.
Yeah, of gin. Yeah.
And then my Mama would spill all the family secrets and all that stuff. Maybe
it's a Southern thing. Am I, as the Yankee here, am I speaking out of turn? I've always known a highball to glass. And so it's.
So I do believe that there is a beverage called a highball.
Okay.
Yeah. A highball and a highball.
Highball and a highball squared. Guys. Yeah.
Double ball. Yeah.
We've done it.
So Byron, Stephen, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with Jeffrey and to me. And we wish you much success on the celebrant and Big Gay Wedding.
Thank you.
This has been so much fun.
It's been so fun.
To getting together in the future with cocktails.
Yes.
We would love to do that. Next time we'll come together with cocktails.
And I'm going to see Jeffrey in Palm Springs. We have Red Clay Smoothie right here. We're so excited.
By the way, can we just take a second to acknowledge these covers? How great did they all
They're look? Beautiful.
Beautiful.
They are beautiful. Beautiful covers.
Yeah. Beautiful guys. Thanks for chatting with us, guys.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so, gentle listeners, until next time, I'm Robert Gwaltney.
And I'm Jeffrey Lofton. Remember, to be creative is to be courageous.